Darkness is not an affirmative force. It simply reoccupies the space vacated by the light.
This is the Hamilton Corner on American Family Radio.
It should be uncomfortable for a believer to live as a hypocrite.
Delivering people out of the bondage of mainstream media
and the philosophies of this world.
God has called you and me to be his ambassadors, even in this dark moment. Let's not miss our moment.
And now, the Hamilton Corner.
Well, hello, everybody. Alex McFarland here. You're listening to the American Family Radio Network, and I have the privilege often for sitting in for attorney, pastor, and journalist Abe Hamilton III, and today is one of those days. We've got a great show for you. Later on in the show, we will talk with Christian Briggs about economics and the analysis of Trump's economic plans, but right now, we're going to talk to attorney Paul Kaminar, and there's so much in the news. My goodness, it seems like just days ago I was in Milwaukee at the Republican National Convention, and I had the privilege of speaking to youth, many of the teens that were there, the teens and their parent. Many of the parents were delegates, and Charlie Kirk and myself, Charlie Kirk of Turning Point USA, and my plane had no sooner landed back in North Carolina than it was rumored that Biden would leave the race. Kamala Harris became the nominee. It was an incredible campaign, very vitriolic, $1.4 billion the Harris campaign spent, and Trump won by 10 million votes. We all know that. It seems like not only every day, but every hour of every day has been just full of news. But the news now, one of the most predominant stories is the pardon of Hunter Biden by President Joe Biden. Now, on six occasions, President Biden said that he would not give a presidential pardon to his son Hunter, and press secretary for the White House repeatedly, with increasing levels of emphasis, said there would be no pardon, and yet there was a pardon. So many people, even on the left, are saying that this is not good. This is not only bad for the legacy of the Biden presidency, whatever that might be, but just for the rule of law itself. And so to help us understand this, we've had several conversations with him over the last year plus. Paul Kaminar, a respected attorney, political analyst, and he is our guest right now. Mr. Kaminar, thank you for making time to be with us. And before we dive into some headlines and the Hunter Biden story, give us your website and tell us about the work you do. Paul Kaminar.
Yeah, great. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I'm the lead counsel of the National Legal and Policy Center. And our website is nlpc.org. And we are a small ethics watchdog group here in the Washington, D.C. area that tries to keep the people here in D.C. and on Capitol Hill and others honest. We file ethics complaints against the likes of AOC and Senator Schumer, and file IRS complaints against, like, Black Lives Matter and FEC complaints. So, and we've been following the Hunter Biden case for years, and on our website you'll see some postings we did, 4 years ago, where we asked the Justice Department to go after Hunter Biden for violating the Foreign Agents Registration Act, meaning he was acting as a foreign agent, getting all this millions of dollars from Ukraine's Burisma oil company and the China energy company, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So, check out our website, and you'll see all the good work that we do.
Well, yes, you do good work. And I had to smile when you said, ethics and Washington, D.C., and keeping the people there honest. I thought, wow, that's a rather ambitious job. God bless you, sir. But so I'm going to cue this up. You know, when you think about Hunter Biden, sad. And look, I take no joy in this, but, with drugs, multiple affairs, restraining orders, guns, China. And here's how I'll throw it to you, Attorney Kaminar. Enter the big guy. Who is the big guy in terms of Hunter Biden?
Right. The big guy is his father, Joe Biden, and we got that information from Hunter Biden's laptop. This is the laptop that was discovered back in 2020, and which during the debate between Joe Biden and Donald Trump for the 2020 election, when this information was coming out, Joe Biden, his first big lie of his candidacy was saying, oh, that laptop is Russian disinformation. That's not legitimate in my son's laptop. Well, and then the media covered that up. So the big guy was implicated very much on the laptop, meaning there was email saying how Hunter Biden was getting lots of money from these foreign sources, and he told his business partners that we have to keep 10% for the big guy. So that's where the big guy comes in, that's why it's no surprise that that Joe Biden was giving a pardon to his son.
Yeah. Yeah, well, family looks after family, don't they? So from what all, this might sound like a simplistic question, but
sure.
How extensive is this pardon? I mean, is Hunter Biden exonerated from, you know, everything of which he has been accused in recent years? And, you know, will he face any prosecutions moving forward?
That's a good question. This pardon was amazing pardon because of not only pardoning for his two criminal violations, the gun charge here in Delaware and the tax charges in California for which he pled guilty. So not only did Joe Biden pardon his son for those two crimes, but he gave him what's called a blanket pardon for any and all crimes that he may have committed from January 1, 2014 until December 1, 2024. So that's 10 years, 11 months, about 2 years, 11 years worth of crimes that he may have committed. So he's off the hook on all that, and there were a lot of things that he could have been charged with if he didn't get the pardon, such as money laundering, getting these millions of dollars that he put through shell companies and distributed to 10 Biden family members over the years, including his uncle Jim Biden, who's Joe Biden's brother, and Joe Biden himself. There's some funny business with money going there. So these money laundering charges were not brought by the prosecutor, nor was the tax violations from 2014 to 2017 involving the money he got from Burisma, which is the Ukrainian oil company. And so Hunter Biden got a break from the get-go by not even being charged with that from the beginning, and just to make sure that doesn't come back to haunt him, this pardon by Joe Biden covers those violations as well. There's also a referral from the House Oversight Committee to the Justice Department last year that both Hunter Biden and Jim Biden lied under oath to the committees and thereby committed perjury. So those
they would be shielded from any charges of perjury under
that's
this.
That's right. That's Hunter Biden. So that brings me to the next issue. Like, well, wait a minute. How about Jim Biden? How about the other family members? How about Joe Biden himself? So I predict that on the day he leaves office, Joe Biden's going to pardon all his family members, especially his brother, Jim, from any criminal prosecution. And, you know, he may even try to pardon himself. That's never been done before. It's not clear whether under the Constitution a president can constitutionally pardon himself. But now that he's pardoned his son Hunter with this blanket pardon, the new Justice Department under Pam Bondi, the new Attorney General, and all these House committees can bring Hunter Biden before a grand jury up to Congress under oath and grill him about all the shenanigans and monies and so forth going to his dad, and how his dad was basically helping him to curry favor with these foreign interests. And what is that Hunter can't say, wait a minute, I plead the Fifth Amendment. I refuse to answer on the grounds that it might incriminate me. Sorry, Hunter, you can't say that anymore because you got a full pardon from your dad. And therefore, you cannot invoke your Fifth Amendment right not to testify. So this blanket pardon may come back to haunt him if in fact, President Biden just pardoned him for the two crimes only. Then Hunter could invoke his Fifth Amendment right if they wanted to get into other things about the money laundering and so forth and so on. Mm-hmm. But now it's open season on having Hunter Biden testify.
You know, let me ask you this. Is there any way that in pardoning the son, the father incriminates himself? Because... No, a pardon implies admission of guilt, right?
Well, no, yeah, a pardon implies admission of guilt of the person being pardoned. In other words, the person who's being pardoned basically admits that, yes, I'm guilty of the crimes for which you're pardoning me, but it only runs to the Hunter, the person being pardoned. It doesn't mean that Joe Biden himself admits that he too committed any crimes. But as I said earlier, that can now be further investigated once the new Justice Department gets in place to see if in fact Joe Biden himself is guilty of some of these money laundering problems and crimes.
Mm-hmm. So what's been like the response of the larger legal community?
Well, even Democrats have said that, politically speaking, this was not a good day for the legacy of Joe Biden because he said, as you said earlier, half a dozen times, promised, I will not pardon my son. So he went back on his word on that, and you know, his reasons for doing that. Now he said, "Well, what changed?" Nothing changed. I mean, he said that, "Oh, this was a political prosecution." Well, Hunter Biden and his attorney has been saying that for a year or two, that this whole thing's been a political prosecution. By the way, it was not. But the bottom line is that was the complaint from the very beginning. So, Joe Biden, why are you raising that reason now? It doesn't make any sense. Number two, that reason doesn't hold any water because, you know, as I said, Hunter got a break by not being charged with other crimes for Foreign Agents Registration Act, et cetera, money laundering. So it wasn't a selective prosecution. And then, you know, you have Joe Biden also said in his statement yesterday, oh, in that tax case, that was just my son. He paid his taxes late, but he paid it all back. So, you know, what's the big deal? It wasn't just a matter of him not paying the taxes, some $1.2 million late. He evaded those taxes by falsely taking business deductions that were false and illegal.
Mm-hmm.
For example.
Hey, Paul, forgive me. Hold that thought. We've got to take a break here. Alex McFarland, along with attorney Paul Kaminar of the National Legal and Policy Center, their website, nlpc.org, nlpc.org. More about Hunter Biden's pardon, and more going on after this break. Stay tuned.
How much control, unfortunately, the executive office does have to direct a lot of these procedures in terms of amnesty, you know, what they can do, even though Congress needs to step it up. And we know constitutionally they should be making sure that the law reflects the American position. But law enforcement is the executive branch. And if you're not enforcing the law, then the law is merely just on paper.
Jenna Ellis in the morning, weekdays at 7 Central on American Family Radio.
Shining light into the darkness. This is the Hamilton Corner on American Family Radio.
Well, he has spoken for the American Bar Association. He's been a guest on Fox News with Tucker Carlson, Good Morning America, Newsmax. Very, very impressive resume. His name is Paul Kaminar. He's the NLPC Council, the National Legal and Policy Center. And hey, I want to say thank you not only for being with us today, and many times you've given your time to be on various programs with us, and I appreciate that, Attorney Kaminar. But I just appreciate your service to our nation. You worked alongside people like Barry Goldwater. If we could digress a moment for the news of the day, just over the decades, how have you seen Washington change, if at all? Maybe it hasn't changed, but what's the Washington of 2024? How is that different from Washington three or four decades ago?
No, that's a good question. I mean, we've had scandals in the past with graft and corruption, with Watergate, with AppScam, and others like that. But what's, I think, a different basically atmosphere and so forth in terms of where we are now is that there's been this weaponization of the Justice Department in the last few years during going after Donald Trump and Republicans and going after conservatives. You know, you had the Merrick Garland Justice Department, FBI, going after parents at school board meetings, objecting to some of the curriculum that they're feeding our youth, and calling these people domestic terrorists, going after in Richmond here, Catholics who also were complaining about some of this stuff. And so you see that weaponization of the Justice Department along those kinds of lines. It used to be basically a fair Justice Department where they would call the balls and strikes evenly. And also the political atmosphere used to be cooperative under Ronald Reagan. I remember well him working with Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, mm-hmm. The liberal Democrat. They would you know, have their differences, but at the end of the day, they could sit down and have a beer and be cordial with one another and get things done. There were a lot of good things back in those days that were done in terms of a lot of different policies that affect both sides, and they were able to work together. Now the environment is very polarized, and it's too bad to see that happen. And you have this fighting going on, and the American people are the ones that are the victims of all that, because Washington is kind of stuck here in terms of getting things done for the American people. So mm-hmm. that's basically the difference that I've seen over the years.
Yeah, and not a lot of trust, even
right.
within like the Republican Party.
All right.
Yeah. So before the break, you were talking about the response of the larger legal community over this.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this, because I know, I mean, we hear from people. I think there's kind of a resignation or just this assumption among the American people that if you're powerful enough, if you've got enough money, if you're famous enough, you're untouchable. They're a two-tier. They're us mere mortals that have to live legally, not have to, it's a privilege to live legally and forthrightly. And then there are the Hunter Bidens of the world that can just live a life like a movie script in a crime drama and get away unscathed. I mean, speak to the American people that they just feel like we're a country where justice doesn't get served anymore.
Well, yeah, that's right. But then you see, like, for example, prosecution against Donald Trump. I mean, he's wealthy and well-known, et cetera, but that didn't help him because he espouses conservative views and policies. And so they went after him after he announced he wanted to run for president in 2024 with these bogus charges. And now the cases are being dismissed here in D.C. and in Florida because Jack Smith is winding down the prosecution, and he cannot, under DOJ law, continue prosecuting a sitting president, which Trump will be. So he went to the two courts and said, hey, look, I can't go after Trump anymore once he's president, so let me have these cases dismissed. And he did something, what he called dismiss the cases without prejudice. That's a legal term meaning he can bring them back again. But that's not going to happen because once President Trump takes office and Pam Bondi becomes Attorney General, she'll file motions to dismiss these cases with prejudice, meaning they can never be brought again, even when Trump gets out of office. So those cases are going away very soon here. And the other cases are lingering, both in the New York case and the Georgia case. But those, I think, will be going away. So yeah, there is this two-system tier of justice. And if you're rich and famous on the liberal side, like, the Hunter Bidens of the world and so forth, you might get a break. But, eventually, I think there'll be a course correction here with the new administration where there'll be more of a fair administration of justice by the Justice Department and the FBI.
Is it fair to say, and I know this is counterfactual, but I don't know, it's fun to think about, or interesting to think about, had Trump not run for president, if he had just ridden off into the sunset and disappeared, all of those 34 charges probably would never have come about, would they?
Oh, absolutely not. None of those 34 charges, nor the Jack Smith and all that. None of those cases would have come about because none of them started until President Trump announced that he wanted to run for re-election. So, it doesn't take a genius to put two and two together to figure out what was motivating those prosecutions. So, thank God he won.
Amen.
If he had lost, oh my God, they would try to put a nail in his coffin. I think, and eventually he would have be vindicated in the Supreme Court just on the merits of these cases. But it would just sap the energy of the American people and just cause more of a political division than what we have right now.
Yeah. Sadly, we're almost out of time. I want to give you a minute to wrap up. I appreciate it very much, not only your analysis today, Attorney Kaminar, but just your work on behalf of ethics in Washington.
Right.
Ethics and Washington, two words that you don't often hear in the same sentence. But any final thoughts?
Well, I think that we need to look forward to the new administration. There's going to be a battle with confirmation of some of the nominees that President Trump has nominated. So I think most of them will be confirmed. There may be some that will have trouble, may have to have a recess appointment, but I think they're going to come in and sort of clean house and get rid of some of the deep state here, and hopefully we'll have a a new day of accountability and some prosperity with the economy and also with peace in terms of these other conflicts that are going on around the world. So hopefully the next 4 years will be renaissance for the American dream.
Indeed, indeed. I concur. Thank you so much, Paul Kaminar.
Sure.
And we're going to change gears here for a second. Alex McFarland on the American Family Radio Network. I'm sitting in for attorney, pastor, broadcaster Abe Hamilton III. And by the way, my own website is alexmcfarland.com, and my books and my broadcasting and my tour schedule and speaking is up there. And I've got a number of things in 2025 that I hope you'll check out if you look at my calendar there on alexmcfarland.com. Well, we're going to change gears. I'm very, very excited to speak with Christian Briggs, who's an economic expert. And much has been said about the Trump economic policy. And let me just say this. Since November 5th, the markets have rallied. Gas prices, it was very interesting. I was on the road literally the day after the election, and I noticed on several gas stations changing the sign. The price of gas went down within days of the election, went down some 10 cents per gallon in some parts of the country, as you know, Trump had been on the road saying, drill, baby, drill. For a lot of measurements, certainly economics among them, the looming Trump presidency seems to bode well. But we're going to get some insight from Christian Briggs. Sir, thank you for holding. Thanks for being with us today, and we look forward to hearing your insights.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be on your program.
Well, thank you. Before we get into some news and analysis and prognostication, tell us about yourself. Give us your website and where people can follow the work that you do, Mr. Briggs.
Well, great. Thank you. So we're one of the largest North American precious metal dealers. We wholesale market gold, silver, select rare coins. Website is B as in Bravo, M. BMCHAM.com. Mm-hmm. But we're wholesalers to the retail public, precious metals and rare coins, one of the largest in North America, and been doing it for about 40 years now.
Wow. I've got an article from the Wall Street Journal called The Dwindling Wealth of America. And talk to us about just in your opinion, the financial stability of the average American family?
Well, that's a great question. Okay, let's talk about stability. Let me back up a couple years, or at least two terms prior. When Donald Trump was running for president in 16 and ultimately won, we were at about a 52% labor force that didn't participate. In other words, they may have worked, but they didn't pay taxes, or they lived on some entitlement. There was some means of which they got by, but they weren't paying into the system. Mm-hmm. And when he took office, he dropped that down to 47%, which means he lifted so many people from the lower middle class, all the way up to upper middle class. He was one of the biggest proponents of offering educational or vocational training to all the different types of African-American, Latinos, or just anybody who wanted it. So he was one of the greatest presidents in history to create the lift, which is going to go back to your original question here in a second. Now, when you look today, under the Joe Biden administration, that 47 jumped up to 62. In fact, we've now gone up to close to 80, if not at 80% of America is living paycheck to paycheck. Mm. So what you've got is a dependency culture, right? So when the Democrats always, and I say this always, it is always, tax and spend, raise the taxes, spend the extra money, create a dependency that mm-hmm. underlines the fabric of America. So instead of going from prosperity of accomplishment, it's basically existing of dependency by the federal government. So if for example, you and I were creating a dependency state, then we knew that if we can get more people taking a handout from us, the likelihood of those people being or staying loyal, at least in a loyalty way because of the money, would keep us in office. They would vote us back in sure. office. So the whole motivation of the Democratic, well, let me go back to Biden administration, was to really inflict as much pain. You'd almost have to think that way, because if they were to really say this one more time, that the inflation was transitory, it'll never give about 5%. I think that's what Janet Yellen said and Paul Bowles said in congressional testimony. It's transitory. It's never going to get above 5%. It's not going to hurt the American public. And we've got it under control, which turned out to be completely wrong. So now you see their motivation. You see them creating a situation where the more people that are dependent upon the Democratic Party, the more likely they're going to stay in power. And mm-hmm. thus, that's the reason why the numbers are the worst in history. I mean, quite honestly, Donald Trump was one of the most favorable presidents in his first term to increase the standard of living for every single person, lower the taxes, bring manufacturing back to America. And within about 100 executive orders, Biden took all that away and made it worse.
Wow. Wow. And you know, the thing is, I mean, isn't it fair to say that both conservative and liberal, and by liberal Democrat, I mean liberal socialist, big government Marxist, I mean, they have a business plan. And like you say, the Democrat promised the world, drill it into the electorate that you can't make it without me. I'm the one that cares about you. You, for your own survival, you must vote Democrat, but it's a tax and spend entitlement dependency class that, I mean, that's their business model, isn't it?
It's 100% their business model, and the way you outlined it was perfect. It is all about creating a state of euphoria that excites the base, that higher taxes only affects the top 5 or 10% of America. Okay, that's what they tell you. Mm-hmm. And two, that equality, okay, the Great Reset is about resetting the wealth inequality. That's the quality of life.
Hey, hold that thought. Forgive me. We've got a break. Christian yeah. Briggs, Hard okay. Asset Management, The Economy, and Your Future. Stay tuned. We'll talk more about this after this brief break on the American Family Radio Network. Don't go away.
Hamilton Quarter podcast and one-minute commentaries are available at AFR.net. Back to the Hamilton Quarter on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to the program. Alex McFarland here sitting in for attorney Abe Hamilton III. We're talking with Christian Briggs. His website, BMCHAM, like BMCHAM.com. And hey, I want to say I'm getting an education, Mr. Briggs, just reading your website here. It's a great website and moves me to believe I need to be investing in gold and precious metals.
Well, you know, it's interesting how I've always told this to people, and I've not been a real aggressive on it until the last couple of years, is that gold is a hedge. We don't know what's going to happen 5 or 10 years from now. Gold always is favorable prior to a catastrophic event. It's mm-hmm. one of the few things in the world that is a precursor. In other words, you can determine things are going to start to become somewhat bad, or it could be a completely a meltdown like in 08 as gold continues to move up. And we've seen gold double in value, in the last 3 years, I guess. So mm-hmm. when you start to look at gold from an investment, it's critical because what it does is it forecasts. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, stock markets and bond markets are reactionary after a catastrophic event when the news was already pretty bad. So gold has been, for the most part, a hedge. It's been an alternative, but it's never been the only investment you should have, but it's certainly a part of something that you're really trying to have a diversified portfolio. So mm-hmm. at the end of the day, we love it. We think it's great, and it's been averaging about 19% annualized return since 1974, and that's not bad.
For real. You know, before the break, you and I were talking about just kind of in simplistic terms, the business model of both parties, conservative and liberal. Talk to us, if you would, a little bit about the debt, because, you know, and believe me, I'm not a political expert, but the tax and spend big government dependency state that goes back, well, I suppose, to LBJ in the 60s. Years ago when I was in college and I was just beginning to become politically aware, I remember thinking, hey, this is not sustainable. I mean, if you just keep adding to the debt, you keep creating people that are dependent but aren't necessarily producing. I mean, that just can't go on forever. And then I've had professors in school that would say, oh, the economy is much more resilient than conservatives think. Conservatives always say the sky is falling. The economy can withstand much, much more dependency. So if you would speak to us, Mr. Briggs, about, money is not infinite. Tax revenue is not infinite. Are conservatives like myself right to be concerned that this just can't go on, this spending and indebtedness and dependency, it can't go on forever?
Well, it's going to go on until it can't. And that's the thing. And so forever is a very long time. So we do agree on both things here. One, it can't continue, and forever is too long. It'll already have, the house of cards will have already dropped and fallen down long before the word forever is utilized. And the reason is that when you have a $7 trillion budget, which is what we had here in 24 coming into the fiscal 25th year of the policies of Joe Biden, $7 trillion, which is just astronomically crazy money. I mean, we're talking hockey stick here in both spending, taxation, because taxation itself has to come somewhere. You're going to have to pay for these revenues because they're willfully just spending crazy, okay? Mm-hmm. When I say revenues, what their outlay is literally putting us in the headwinds of a debt default. And let me give you some statistical and mathematics behind it. When you start to look at the last 35, not quite really 36 years, less than 40, but a little more than 34, we've had basically a declining interest rate environment in this country, certainly from the early 80s. Okay, 40 plus years ago, interest rates were at 12, 13, 14%. So they really declined. It has a few bumps in 08 where they did move up a little bit, and then we crashed them again, and we kept them low. By 2020, we're at 2% mortgages, which you might as well just give away the money for free at that point. So mm-hmm. We've had two generations, basically, or close to it, of interest rate environments that were declining, which helped the credit markets. Well, if you look at what the houses, an average home cost in, let's say, the early 80s, it was about $83,000. Today, it's about $600,000, roughly. And in over 600 communities in America, give or take, we have homes that have a median price of between $900,000 and $1 million. That's crazy. The home values in the markets have gone up way disproportionately to incomes. So we've had socialized spending to make up the gap between the have and have nots. Example, when you start to think about real wages, they're up about 400% in the last 30 years. That's it. Homes are up 50-fold. So we've created an artificial market through government spending, by government borrowing. And what's happening at these next generations, we now have a debt that theoretically, we've only got $4.5 to $5 trillion worth of top-line revenues in this country. How are you going to pay $36 trillion back? You had average debt was financed at about 75 basis points, not even a percent, on the 10, the 20s, and the 30s, or certainly the short-term maturity treasuries. Now we've got 4.25, 4.5%. So now we've seen a 300, 500, and 8-fold increase and the amount of interest you're paying. The debt was $7 trillion under Obama. We're $36 trillion now. These are disproportionate mathematics. In other words, mm-hmm. no matter how you put it on paper, the government has to either devalue the currency dramatically to be able to bring down the value of the debt. If that happens, then you're seeing why gold's going up. Gold is hedging. What is inevitably going to happen is somehow we're going to have to devalue the currency.
Mm-hmm. Now,
there's no way around it. The only way to do that is to get rid, and then you get rid of the debt. Go ahead.
But every cause has an effect. So you devalue the American currency to make that debt number look a little more manageable. But what does that mean on the world stage? I mean, how strong is the American dollar versus the other currencies of the world?
Well, okay. Another great question. These are questions that you don't get asked a lot, but I'm glad you did. If you look at gold, and there's an old term in physics that for every action, there's a reaction. Usually it's the opposite. Okay, one goes up, one goes down by the very definition of matter moving forward or matter moving or not at all. It could be stationary. What we're seeing for the first time in history is everything is going down simultaneously against one common denominator, gold. In other words, you're seeing every currency, it's having to, it's at today's value of gold, let's just say it's about 2650, I think is where it's at right now. You literally look back 6 months from now, every currency in the world, it now requires more of that currency to buy the gold than it did 6 months ago, a year ago, 2 years ago. Gold is letting the world know. And the reason why central banks around the world are buying so much gold is because anticipation of a currency collapse or, at the very least, a currency devaluation or catastrophic event that would devalue all currencies simultaneously, which is a kind of against physics, but it's not. When you're using the correlation between gold, which is real money, real monetary policy, if you want to get right down to it, and paper currency, which is really just promissory notes that you hope and you pray that the government still honors them, and they will, but the value, as an example, $10,000 in 1971, if you had kept that $10,000 in cash, it's worth $200 today in buying power. It's worth almost $1 million in gold. So where was the value? In cash or in gold? So gold hedged the devaluation of the U.S. dollar, and from pretty much most all of currencies for that matter, but the same amount of money. So we're witnessing the changing of how perception of value is, not in paper currency, but in hard currency, which is gold. And gold is telling everybody, we have problems because the world debt right now is just a hair under $400 trillion. There's no way that you're going to pay that back. That's theoretically impossible. We've done analysis here. You can't. You're going to have to devalue the currencies further and able to even get to a point where you might be able to tackle the debt. And even then, it's very challenging.
So when someone invests in gold, what does that mean? In a safe deposit box somewhere, you've got, literal coins or bullion. What does it mean to invest in gold?
Well, investing in gold is really easy. You take gold in the form of different things, and you put it in your safe deposit box under your bed in your attic or your gun safe, where a lot of people do. And what you have there is an asset that has been averaging in 5 and 10 year average terms about 19% a year, that you don't have to worry or monitor the company, the management team, or what it's doing. It's the most passive investment with one of the greatest returns, and it's super simple. It just buy it and you own it. There's not many companies or real estate that has zero annualized cost to own, doesn't have any cost. It's not like an ETF, you have to pay a management fee or a wealth manager or real estate, you have to pay real estate taxes, insurance and maintenance and upkeep even if it's rented. So owning it is super simple. It reflects on a great hedge against devaluation. But more importantly, the central banks around the world have been buying it at record pace and record amounts because they're starting to realize that the paper asset market is now coming to what may be a time of reckoning, certainly within the next 3 years. And for your listeners, I'll kind of give you some ratios here, which is really good because statistics are the only way to look at things. It takes the emotion out of it, as many people know. But when you look at in the last 30-plus years, there have been 52 countries that have achieved a milestone. Not a good milestone, but it's a milestone nevertheless. Okay, we'll at least give them that. Where their debt is 130% greater than their GDP. Or
how many countries?
The ratio thereof. There's been 52 that have achieved this 130% debt to GDP ratio, okay, 52 in the last 30-plus years, about 30, 35 years. Of the 52, 51 have gone bankrupt. They've literally filed bankrupt. The only one who hasn't is Japan, and if you've ever seen their financials lately, it's the Enron model. It's no doubt. It's something that you would look at and go, there's no way this can exist. 300% GDP ratio, the Japanese government, the Bank of Japan buys all of the debt they put out there. It's incomprehensible. You can't do it in much longer. And they'll be the 52nd country that he has to realign their currency. Well, let's talk about the United States. Where are we? Well, I'm glad you asked. So our ratio is 124%, give or take a half a percent each way. We're at 124. Do you know that 8 years ago we were at 44%? Now we're at 124. The breaking point's 130. At the current rate of spending, if the interest rates stay elevated, which they will, they'll stay elevated. They're not going to go back down to a half a percent. I can assure you on that. That's not going to happen. That means in 3 years, in fiscal 28, really into 27, technically about the second half of 27 into 28, we will be running at 155%. We will have passed the tipping point.
That's well, is there any way to avoid that, though?
Sure. There's great ways, but it's painful. Elon sent a tweet out. Many of your viewers probably saw it or your listeners. And it was that if Trump wins, equity markets are going to suffer a fairly significant loss. Now, he didn't mean that the next day, the next week, or the next month. He meant that if Trump wins, he's going to have to go in there and surgically cut government spending. They, Vivek, who I know, and Elon, I don't know Elon personally, but I know Vivek, who's a rock. He's a rock star. He's a very smart guy. They're going to go in there and they're going to try to chop $2 trillion out of government spending, which in theory sounds great. And if there's any two people that can put together a team to do it, they're probably the guys. But I don't see them quite cutting that much because government spending now accounts for about 60% of the economy. Really, it does. When it translates into every dollar government spends into the economy, entitlements, military, healthcare, all those different variables. So they're a huge part of the economy. You can't just take a third of the economy and go, oh, well, we're not going to do it anymore. That would be too austerity measures. Government would not go for that. But in saying that, the only way to do it is going to be a painful way of cutting. You're going to have to cut government spending, but where do you cut it? And obviously, I'm not part of the Doge team, but I do know anybody who looks at the books is going to have to come away with the same thing I did when I looked at some of the Treasury reports. Social Security is now like $1.3 trillion, $1.4 trillion this year with all the inflation adjustment numbers. Medicare is $1 trillion. You've got interest on the debt, $2 trillion and thereabouts into fiscal 25. I mean, I don't know where you're going to cut because the revenues are going to be around 4.7 to maybe $5 trillion in fiscal 25. Spending is going to be well over $7 trillion, probably 7.5 to maybe $8 trillion with government debt spending. So what you have to look at is where do they cut? Mm-hmm. And really, it's a little bit of everywhere. You're going to have to cut something from every single department, shutting down Department of Education, which I think they mentioned now a couple of times, but it doesn't sound so bad.
Yes.
But okay, so you're saving $200 billion, $300 billion a year.
I beg your forgiveness. We are just about out of time. Christian Briggs, Hard Asset Management, BMCHAM.com. Listen, we've got to talk again. We're all getting an education, and we thank you for that. Alex McFarland here, thanking you for listening to the Hamilton Corner. Keep your radio tuned to AFR. May God bless you.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.